Hello everyone, I'm Sagar Baroshi.
And I'm John Ingold.
This is the Game Nerd of Kaleidoscope podcast. Every week, we flip to a page of the book, the Game Nerd of Kaleidoscope book, and we invite an author on to talk about their contribution to that book. It's all about the craft of game writing, how we put together stories with different angles and different contexts. This week, we have a particularly unique angle for us to cover. It's Adriana X. Jacobs, who's here to join us. Welcome, welcome. Hello.
Hi.
It's very, very good to have you. Would you start, please, by telling us about yourself? What brought you not just into the world of poetry, but into the world of games as well?
Well, I think that answer could fill this whole podcast. So I will try to go for it. I'll try to just to give the highlights. So I think my trajectory is a little, well, I don't know if it's unusual, because the more I meet people who do game design and narrative game design, I feel like everyone has sort of a different path to it. Mine is that my background is that professionally, I'm a professor of Hebrew literature at the University of Oxford. My training is in comparative literature with a focus on poetry and literary translation. So I started off working with a Spanish language literature and translating Spanish language poetry into English. And then a long time ago, towards the end of my undergraduate degree, I decided to pick up a third language and started studying modern Hebrew and became completely hooked and passionate about Hebrew and ended up sort of focusing my doctoral literary studies on Hebrew literature, but again, focused on the areas that I love most, which are poetry and translation. So that is what brought me to Oxford in 2013. And for the next 10 years, my career path was pretty conventional. It just was sort of a standard academic path. You know, I published my first monograph, which was based off of my dissertation, and then wrote a lot of articles, peer-reviewed articles, where I said things, you know, in what follows, I will argue this or that, or, you know, coining lots of terms. And It was a pretty sort of robust and, according to some, impressive career in this sort of niche field of Hebrew literature. But then in early 2020, the pandemic happened, and I was in Oxford with my family, and we were locked down for the next 8 months. And during that time, I had played video games in my 20s. I wasn't someone who really played video games as a child. I mostly just liked to read books and watched my siblings play on our Nintendo console and feigned excitement when they sort of rescued the princess at the end of Super Mario Brothers, but otherwise didn't really care much for video games. And then in my 20s, I started dating my now husband, and all of his friends were really into Pokemon, and they had these, you know, video games were now on these little handheld devices, and I started to play, and I really loved it. And I remember this was the early aughts, and I remember telling people in graduate school, I was like, you know, video games are just, they have such literary value. And then it was like, I had sprung three heads and people thought I was insane. But at the time, you know, the internet wasn't what it is now. And I had found some blogs where there was a lot of interesting writing about games, but it just didn't seem like games were a thing you could really focus on. And certainly didn't seem to me as something you could make a living doing. So I stuck with my path of just wanting to become a professor of literature. So that's just to say that during the pandemic, when I was watching my family just absorbed in video games as a social outlet during a time of lockdown, I felt really jealous. I wanted to sort of experience that too. And we just happened to have a copy of The Last of Us. So I put, you know, I started playing it. And by the time the credits rolled, I was like, my life has changed. I really just felt like games had done exactly what I thought they were capable of doing and what they had always been doing, which is they were telling really rich stories in exciting ways. And I felt like I was ready to immerse myself in that world. I'd spent a lot of time in sort of traditional academic writing formats and felt that at a certain point I had sort of lost my own passion for storytelling and for talking about and writing about literature. And then from there, it just sort of ballooned into a kind of obsession with playing video games, wanting to make them, and eventually taking a break from Oxford for 2 years to do an MFA in game design at NYU, which I completed a few weeks ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And so I'll be going back to Oxford in the fall, but as both a Hebrew literature professor and a game designer. So my research will be focused on developing my thesis game into a full game. So that's how I would answer that question today.
Brilliant. What a background. We haven't had someone quite with this combination, certainly ever, really. Although, I mean, I think there's a chance we might have had some people in academia before. But this is really unique. I mean, there's so many things here. Your thesis project VIA would be so interesting for us to look into. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of interesting topics here about translation we'd love to do. So before I'm chomping at the bit, John, over to you.
Yes, absolutely. Well, no, I was going to say, I think we've had one fully fledged academic on the show before, but it's very cool to see that pipeline working as well. I think I'm always interested in how games can reach out to the community of people who don't really know what they're capable of doing, and like sometimes mm-hmm. I despair that we just can't break that wall. So it's always kind of it's always quite heartening when you see people kind of finding games and kind of seeing their value as well. You think, oh, thank God I wasn't making it up all these years. It's very reassuring. So that's lovely. But let's talk about your article for the book first as a standard jumping off point. So we normally ask guests to outline the thesis of the article, which your title rather gives it sort of, it's the opposite of burying the lead. It rather gives the game away. But your article is called Poems Make Games Better, which is a glorious assertion. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about what do you mean by that and why do you think it's true?
Yeah, I think you're right, the title sort of encapsulates kind of the thrust of that piece. But it's also, I think, meant to be a little provocative. So a lot of things make games great, poems among them. But as someone who's a poet, I do a lot of poetry writing and translating poetry. I just love poetry. So I just, whenever I see a poem in a game, which is not all the time, but actually surprisingly more common than I would have expected, maybe because I'm always looking out for it, and maybe also because of the way I define poetry. I always get really excited. I love seeing poems in games, and I think that whether they're lore objects or sort of part of a kind of narrative mechanic, they allow the player opportunities to kind of do some of that kind of emergent narrative work that I think can encourage a player to feel more invested in a game, and certainly contributes to feeling like one's gameplay experience is unique in some way because of the way that poems, I think, allow for multiple sort of readings and interpretations. So that would be one way of answering that question. So I think in my essay, I wanted to look specifically at poems as objects in a game and to think about the work that they're doing in the game when they appear. And I pulled from three very different games where poems occupy very different sort of roles and spaces. So like in Clair Obscur, it's an object that you encounter and it's not consequential, and it can also be entirely missable just because it's not part of the main mission or the game's critical path. But then you have Hades 2, where every time you enter into Circe's island, you are thrust into her poem, whether you want to be or not. And so I also just wanted to think about the different ways that poems appear in games and the different forms of engagement that players are encouraged to have with them.
So I really liked the thesis of your article. It was funny for me reading it because I was sort of thought, oh, that's an interesting take. And then I was reflecting back on the games that Inkle's been making over the years and mm-hmm. noticing that we've been including poetry kind of more and more and repeatedly. I think the first time we really did was at the start of Heaven's Vault, which is an archaeology game. There's a quote from the Egyptian mm-hmm. Book of the Dead because I found it and mm-hmm. it just worked very well and I liked the aesthetic of it. But just there's something about the way that poetry, I don't know whether it forces us or encourages or perhaps just invites us to slow down and stop and actually mm-hmm. consider in some detail, which is quite, it's almost controversial as a thing to do in games in some ways. Like so much game design is devoted to keep the player moving forward, keep the player on track, keep the player progressing, like keep this conveyor belt going. Like we can't, as designers, we're terrified the player will put the controller down and stop doing anything for a while. Mm-hmm. But in contrast to that, a lot of people's most memorable moments in games are, you know, you climb up in the old PlayStation days, you climb up a vista and you see a sudden gorgeous landscape in front of you and you just stop and look at it for a bit because you've been stuck in corridors for so long. Or there's a story that somebody was relating on the podcast, I think, about a player who in a playtest of a Batman game put the controller down and just sat in a corner not moving. And they asked him, you know, do you not understand the buttons? He was like, shh, I'm being Batman. And like just these moments of quiet and thought actually mm-hmm. being almost what we're aiming for in a way. And kind of poetry is quite a nice hack for that in a way, because people, when they see a poem, they either just ignore it completely and don't want to engage with it at all because that's how they feel about poetry and that is a thing. But they kind of know what to do with it. People know that they're supposed to read it slowly and think about it in a way that perhaps if you give them like a subtle piece of dialogue, they might go, oh, I just didn't understand that. They might not stop and reconsider it. So I kind of really related to that, that idea of using poetry as a kind of way of teasing out a different kind of pacing in a game. Yeah. Does that kind of match with what you were thinking?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I have a lot of, I have so many thoughts I'm trying to tease out. I think one, because you mentioned the Heaven's Vault epigraph, I'm always so interested when there is the inclusion of a poem as, say, an epigraph, because for me that signals like that there's a desire to sort of communicate something or to sort of set up some kind of mood or tone in a narrative, but to do so in a way that maybe isn't explicit or direct. And I think poetry allows for that. Like you can sort of give readers a sense of like, well, this is what's coming ahead, but I'm not mapping it out for you. You still sort of need to figure out what the themes are and sort of what this tone and style are. But this snippet of a poem becomes a kind of a little sort of slit in a window or something that kind of gives the reader a little bit of an opening without delivering too much. But it can also serve as a bit of a puzzle. So then maybe a reader goes back to that and it's like, oh, the epigraph was always telling me this and or signaling this theme.
Yeah, I definitely really relate to that. I think for me, I'm constantly putting epigraphs in games and it's because I like the sense that they're a riddle. I like the idea that the player will come back to it having played the game and go, oh, now I understand. And I don't really know why I like that so much. It just feels more complete when that's there or something, perhaps. Proves to me that I know what I'm talking, what the game is about or something like that. But sorry, I interrupted you just to refuse.
That's great. Yeah, I think also, in poetry, epigraphs are also a way of acknowledging your sources or your inspirations. And it can become a kind of shorthand for creating a sort of sense of lineage between texts. So that can be also really interesting. They're like intertextual in that way. So I think, you know, if you want to sort of, maybe even within a game, it can be really helpful if like later there is, say, the appearance of the Book of the Dead or something. And then a player will be like, oh, right. And the game started with that epigraph. So the clue was always there all along. And that's sort of also related to the puzzle component. But going back to sort of the slowing down, yeah, I find that really fascinating, especially in the context of the game that I'm currently making, Via, where there's a lot of insistence on slowing down the reader to read text, and to read text that's often very poetically charged, if not actual poetry. One of the things that I found really interesting, for example, in Hades 2, when you enter into Arachne's space, is the way Arachne recites her poems, and they are poems. I mean, formally and stylistically, they're very much poems. Is she reads them very slowly. And so there's a temptation. I mean, you can sort of run up to her and interrupt her, and then she'll stop and she kind of gives this little sigh. It's like, okay, like you didn't really want to listen to me. But if you sort of go with her pace, it's really interesting in a game where sometimes like you enter certain rooms and you're instantly flung into a combat, like a highly charged combat situation. And then you go into Arachne's room and she's reciting very slowly. I would find myself sometimes also just slowing down and sort of inching my way towards her. And then she repeats it, which I think is clever because it evokes the kind of roguelike form. She'll be like, once more. And so then you just listen to the text again. So I think there, if the player is open to that influence, I think the slowing down or trying to match the pace is really fascinating. But I've also watched players play Returnal, which is one of my favorite games and has had an enormous influence on my approach to narrative design. There are a lot of when you enter this like house that pops up every once in a while, there are a lot of books that have like short stories or like excerpts that you can read. And then in the DLC Ascension, there are these two poems that I mentioned in my Kaleidoscope piece, these poems. And I watched once this player just like, I think it was in Ascension, like pick up the book with the poem and go, ah, never mind. And like, just, it was like the equivalent of tossing it in the air. And I was like, how can you not want to read The Myth of Sisyphus? Like, it's just sort of like,
how relevant is it for what the game itself, right?
You know, I know you can play the game without reading it, but it was sort of, I felt like, yeah, it was hysterical, but I thought also unfortunate. And there's not much, I mean, you can choose to force engagement, like the screen locks and they can't leave unless a certain amount of time passes. But I think we all know that, you know, how alienating and punishing this is for in certain kinds of games, like I think a heavy combat game, like a third person bullet hell shooter like Returnal, maybe can't quite get away with it. But I do think it's also related to pacing, because that player clearly just wanted to get back into battle and did not want to have to be dealing with this poem. So I think that choice also kind of then, as both a player and as a designer, I'm like, I spent a lot of time thinking about the implications of not reading and choosing to kind of stay in a certain tempo as you're playing. So
I think it's interesting, that kind of design thing, of the variation of pace that you can offer some players, and some players don't want it, because sometimes it feels like, well, shouldn't we be making players play the version of the game that we've imagined, like that has these ups and these downs and these kind of lulls? And then on the other hand, one could say, well, I suppose the player who's just charging through the combat, wanting more of the combat, he's having a great time. Like, if he doesn't need a poetry and a change of place to kind of like break up the experience for him, then he's fine and we don't need to worry about him. But for the people who maybe actually would appreciate it, then here is this thing. And I kind of, for myself as a designer, I go backwards and forwards on how much we should be shaping the experience for the player in the way that a filmmaker very much does, and how much we should be inviting the player in the way that perhaps an immersive theater show might sort of say, well, these things are on offer, but you don't necessarily have to come to them. Is that something that perhaps is different in each kind of title that we write, or it just depends on the context, Or do you think we should be aiming to, I don't know, make the experience of games a little bit more highbrow on average? Like, should we be pushing the bar actively? Do we have a responsibility to be doing that? Or is it not worth worrying about?
I mean, I think it, honestly, I don't have a single answer, but I mean, I really just think it comes down to the game you're making. And I think there are certain games that maybe, you know, they make a strong case for sort of locking the player into a particular experience. I'm thinking of Edith Finch, for example, which is, you know, I remember, there are a lot of scenes in that game where I really wanted to get out of them because they were just so harrowing. I'm thinking of, you know, when you're cutting up the fish, or even the kite, or the bathtub. Oh God, the bathtub, I couldn't figure out how to make it. How to make it end. And I really wanted it to. And there was just, I just was like desperate at a certain point. And that's not a game, I think, for obviously. I guess I'm also just, I don't believe every game is for everyone. But then, of course, at some point, you know, if you're selling games and you're marketing them, you're going to have to sort of make some sort of tough choices about reach and accessibility. But I also think it's okay for a game to just say, this is the game we're making, and this is how you have to play it. And then if a player plays it, they sort of are in some ways like signing a contract of sorts to do that. And you know, you can always stop playing. I mean, I find it so interesting about all these forms, whether it's a book or a song or a movie or a game, is that at some point you don't have to do that thing. You know, you can walk out of the theater, you can turn off the song, you can close the book, you can stop playing the game. I think what interests me a lot is like why someone chooses to keep going. And then as a designer, I want them to keep going. But at the same time, I'm aware that, you know, at any point that choice to stop is always there. And I think one way, I had the opportunity, we had a showcase for our thesis games. And this is like a small digression, but it might be related. I had been told that, because Via is a narrative game, and it's a side scroller basically. And right now it has two levels and they're not totally connected. And it requires that you do a lot of reading. In the first level, in fact, the player, it stops moving when there's like a text box is triggered, and that can be really annoying for players who just want to keep moving through. But I did that intentionally, and I had been told that narrative games were generally unsuccessful in the showcase setting because it's very loud and chaotic and there are a lot of people and no one's going to sit there and just play a narrative game. And actually a lot of people played Via, and I was really like surprised and delighted. And I think that for me, it was like a reminder that I do think people are drawn to good writing. They're open to being surprised. They're even open to being frustrated. The number of people who sort of suffered through this like crazy kite dialogue mechanic that I had in one level was astounding. A few people did give up, and that's okay. They were like, I'm done. And I'm like, no problem. But most people actually worked their way through it. And a lot of people did it without asking me for any hints or advice. And so I do think that sometimes we underestimate a player's willingness to kind of suffer through something just to get through the story.
Yeah. I like this. I like the way that you said this. I think I agree with you, actually, that like, fundamentally, we're talking about there are multiple different audiences that might arrive at a game, and you can try to really plan for them and like really sort of find a way of uniting them, or you can say, hey, here's the thing as it is, and some of you might like parts of it, and others of you might find it tolerable enough to be able to keep moving on. The thing I find most interesting is the topic you said at the very start, actually, which is about missability, if that's even a real word. I think that when I think of most of the poetry I've seen in games, you must be right that maybe I've just not been looking for it. I'm sure it occurs more often than I think. It tends to be in lore objects and collectibles and things you can kind of pick up. And I think it's actually because of this very same thing that I was just mentioning, that it becomes a thing you can engage with if you want to, but you don't have to, like in a sense, like in Returnal Ascension, you were saying. Side note, I would be very curious what you think of Saros, their recent release, which is also very literarily pulled from Robert Chambers, who himself has, includes a lot of poetry in his work, but is also like very gothic and very, very intense in the way that, that it happens. Very curious what you think. But yeah, so there's this question of miscibility, right? So in your art, in your essay, the first thing you do in your essay is you exclude certain types of poetry. And I would love to ask you about this. So you exclude the types of poetry in like Doki Doki Literature Club, a very good game, right? And you talk about Play a Hot Number, which I'm less familiar with. But I think so I think what you were doing is you were sort of saying if the poem is a plot object, then that in some ways might be less interesting than the poem that a player chooses to engage with. Is that correct? Or tell me more about what you were thinking about.
Yeah, I think if I'd had another 500 words, I would have expanded a little bit more. Yeah, I think I was trying just to distinguish between games where poetry is the game. It's like kind of that is the, like in Doki Doki Literature Club, poems are the game. I mean, that's like you're writing poems, you're reading poems, that's the poems are absolutely unmissable. Play a Hot Number is one of my professors at NYU's Game Center, Laura Suits Clark, made a game several years ago, which is a poetry combinator. So that's obviously like that is a game where you are making poems. You're right that in some ways there is this element of like the lore object that you can sort of pass by or completely miss entirely. Although I think that's why with Hades too, it's not entirely unmissable.
It's half and half.
There are ways you can sort of disrupt the poem and fast forward through that a little bit. But yeah, I think for me, it was more like games where just the poems are not sort of central, or they're not part of some sort of like, they're not central to the narrative necessarily. Although I would argue as someone who reads poetry very closely, I find ways to make the poems very central. I wrote this whole article that on translation and video games, and there's an entire section about an epitaph poem in Resident Evil 4. And I somehow managed to squeeze, you know, a couple thousand words about why this epitaph poem is sort of like critical to the narrative of the whole game. But that's my inclination, because I do see these moments and these texts as having a great deal of meaning. But yeah, I think I'm also just fascinated by the sometimes the randomness of this object.
Right. If it's fully constructed and it's just a thing you find, you have to deal with it or ignore it. Like those are your options.
But then I'm like, why would someone choose to put it in there? Like, there must be at some point a conversation, or maybe not, about this object, and it's part of the world building. And then I'm like, but then why a poem? Because sometimes these poems are really good, and I'm like, that takes time. That's not something you just whip out, you know, in 5 minutes. So, yeah,
I think that's really interesting, though, actually, because that draws, I think that draws a really important distinction in the way that players approach the, I don't want to say the content of the game, but the kind of the material within the game, in that we often model players as being these kind of Terminator style people that kind of have a filter over them, and they look at the world and they assess it into threats and like walls and arbitrary nonsense. So, you know, there's that classic complaint that we build incredibly visually beautiful games and then players look at them and quietly ignore everything in them so that they can focus on the parts of the game that are important. And after a while, they're just playing the same game they were playing 25 years ago when it didn't look so good, because they're only interested in the moving parts. But I think you're right that if we can encourage players to approach something and ask about the intentionality of it and say, okay, well, someone put this poem in here. So were they just filling up a lore content spreadsheet because that was their job and they had to do that? Or is that here because it's trying to tell me something that's worth knowing? And like, I love that it's just, and the thing that I worry about, I suppose, is how do we communicate to players that that intentionality really is there when they're training themselves so often to kind of strip mine a game for its content and kind of very quickly triage, you know, this is not relevant, this is relevant. And I think poetry is quite a good way of doing that in a way, because as you say, it's quite hard to write actually. Like, you can't just bust a poem out. Someone clearly made an effort to put that in a way, perhaps more than if there's some beautiful trees in a courtyard, people go, oh, it's just some trees, they're not, I don't need to worry about it. And I think maybe that that comes down to an idea of making, almost making the poems interactive in some way, not necessarily you can play with them or push buttons, but you stop, you take them in, and you work on them in a way that
this is what I wanted to bring up, actually.
A nice bit of geometry in the world. You don't, but sorry. You,
No, but you please go ahead and react to that first, and then I'll take my turn.
Oh, wait, so which part? Just can you say that
whichever
last
part
little...
You like. So I was thinking that that when we build like a beautiful bit of scenery, it isn't interactive in a way if the player just looks at it and goes, oh, yeah, that's nice. But there's nothing to unpick and understand about it. Whereas when we present someone with a poem or a song or even like an interesting piece of dialogue, suddenly they're pretty much forced to start asking questions about it and start interpreting it. And that's a great hook.
Right. Yeah, I think for me, a great example of that, of how a poem can actually pull a player closer into the game and its environment, but also into its themes and arguments, it happens in Stray, in the Ant Village level, where you can... Again, it's optional. You can have an interaction with one a sort of robot character named Alexander. And Alexander's a poet robot. And the poem that Alexander recites is really, really quite moving for me, because you're in this space that, you know, it's like, there are no more humans, or humans have somehow, they've all died off. There's been some major calamity. You're in a sewer system and one of the pipes is like dripping water. And Alexander's poem is about like this beautiful waterfall. And so it's a moment where it's like you're seeing the residue of human creativity sort of projected back to the human player of the game. And also just this sort of reimagining of this space that you're in. I mean, this is like a sewer system and it's not a waterfall. It's just a pipe that's bursting with some water that's like moldy and gross. But it's also how like language and art can reconfigure the world that we're in. And sometimes in ways that can be delusional, but also can be very healing and cathartic. And so it's one of my favorite moments in that game. But again, I've watched quite a few playthroughs of that level. And it's interesting to me how easy it is to just walk by Alexander, the poet, and not interact with them. And there's nothing, you don't get a memory object, you don't get anything from that interaction. All you get, but you get the poem. And I actually think that that is like a meaningful collectible item that doesn't register in the inventory at all. But it's
in
part of
it's...
kind of your emotional inventory of the game. So.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in some ways it's a better test, right? Because if you sat to collect it, you have no other incentive to do it. And you're really in there. That, I mean, it makes sure that the person who's sitting there listening to Alexander, it's a great game, right? That one starts to question, like, does Alexander know and is just self, you know, doing it on their own? These are the questions that the writers clearly wanted you to engage with. Right. It's funny when you were talking about, poetry as maybe an actual mechanic or as an actual plot device, it put me in mind of Ghost of Tsushima. I don't know if Ghost of Yote does this as well. It may do. I haven't played it, but in Tsushima, you have haiku moments, right? So you go, you rest, you sit down, and you write a haiku as part of your rest moment, and you write it. Uh-huh. And it's an open world game, right? So these are locations scattered around the map. So you go to a certain location, and the player gets to In working out, because the structure is so fine, in working out what to write about, they can select items in the environment that happen to be visible from their spot, from the spot of reflection and meditation. In some cases, they'll speak about frogs mm-hmm. on the pond. In some cases, they'll speak about starlings in the trees, what have you, right? And that becomes mm-hmm. the first line. A different set of options becomes available for the second. So you're constructing poetry. You have a mechanical advantage, which is it's allowing you to rest, I believe, and maybe save the game. I can't entirely recall, actually. But it's this hybrid moment. They're not required, right? So, I mean, we've been talking about this whole conversation, which is like, is it okay for you to have to miss those things? And I think maybe we all have slightly different feelings about those things, or we think maybe if you missed it, it's a shame. But I suppose, I guess I'm on the side of, I almost think it's enhanced if it's there and available, but you choose not to engage with it. But you make it, as the designer, really engaging and interesting for people beyond just the core audience that is going to read every lore item. Like, I didn't even read the Isabel journal. I listened to it, right? Like, every journal entry in Expedition 33, I listened mm-hmm. to it. But, like, I wrote a DLC for this game, Still Wakes the Deep. And in Still Wakes the Deep, it's a horror game. Set in the North Sea, and the whole game is called Still Wakes the Deep, and you never quite know why. And then 3/4 of the way into the game, you find an in-universe written poem, a diegetic moment, like a notebook where someone has written out the full poem that ends in the line that includes Still Wakes the Deep. You realize that the entire game has been named after this poem, and it is a missable object, but it's been placed in a location where it's very hard to miss. You sort of end up there being very likely to find it. Yeah. And that type of thing, like the way it was done there, the way it was done in Ghost, it feels like that's a nice in between where you sort of already train the player to either want something for mechanical reason or for a pacing reason where they are opting into it, or it's part of the behavior they're already doing in the game. Then maybe you're getting the biggest possible audience for that moment. I don't know. Yeah. But what do you think? Yeah. Would you agree?
No. I've known for a long time that I should be playing Ghosts of Tsushima. And also I did go to a GDC I went to my first GDC this year, and I stumbled into an amazing panel on combat design in Ghost of Yote. And I kept thinking, God, the way they design the combat is so poetic.
It's choreography.
Now I feel like I absolutely have to play these games, especially I love this idea of the composing the haiku and pulling from the environment. Just that sounds really appealing to me, but also a very clever way to kind of, give a player the option to sort of
To
interact a little more with the space. But
you're completely right. I played your game Corvus that you have on your site, right?
And you
went very bold with this, where you were let's have free text entry and see what happens. We actually just did a podcast about the challenge of designing a sort of free text entry system, what it's like for these types of games, right? But this is the problem. If you want to put poetry as a mechanic in your game, of course this is the problem. How do you know what's in the player's mind? How do you evoke it?
Right.
So essentially having them like pick drop downs, but beautifully, in some beautiful way, is a nice solution, right?
Yeah. No, I think that's cool. And I think like games that do this sort of, poetry combinators or just Doki Doki. Mm. Also, I think you can sort of pull text to make games. I appreciate there the willingness to kind of give the player a feeling that they're kind of like in a sort of poetry workshop and they're doing, some composition as part of the game. I think that, again, it all comes down to the game that you're making. And, I think like, in Returnal, for example, there are these really beautifully written, compelling scout logs that you can pick up. And A.V. Korhonen, who was the lead narrative designer for that game, has talked about how one of the questions they ask themselves is, they wanted players to pick up these scout logs. You don't have to, there's no reward for doing it. There's no permanent item you'll get at the end. But they were aware that players weren't going to want to pause and like listen and so they did it in this way where it's like you pick it up and they're very short and you can keep moving. And they don't, the recording's not super long. So you pick it up and you hear the voice and you start like running into the next room or biome to battle whatever monsters are there. And you can hear the recording in the background. So that became one way that they sort of resolved this particular tension between like a player's expectations in terms of pacing and then the desire to actually kind of encourage some sort of interaction with these texts. So I think that's one way, you know, in a combat thing. But yeah, I think there are other places where you can sort of, I think over time, inspire players to sort of invest in a pause, like at a campfire or, you know, they're just I think sometimes transitional moments can be like a really good place to do this. This is why I love how Hades 2 does it, which is like, as you walk through the gate, like whatever they call it, the door into the next scene, that triggers the poetic voiceover. So, which is different from like, say, oh, there's this object here and I have to click it. And then that's going to open it up. Yeah.
This is the other thing that as a game we can do that's maybe quite unique, which is the performance makes a huge difference, I think, to these things. If you're reading it, it really feels very different than if it's been performed by a professional actor, right?
Absolutely.
You really feel a poem so much more. I mean, so often, right? In most of history, they were intended to always be read out loud, right? Or to be recited.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely think the performance makes a huge difference. And I will say that having attended a lot of poetry readings in my lifetime, I think that sometimes living poets could learn a great deal from the way game actors perform poems. I think, you know, Arachne, I should have written down the name of the actor who plays Arachne. That voice actor just does such a good job as Arachne. And when they read those poem snippets, it's just so, it's really appealing. Like you're drawn to the text because you're also drawn to the performance of it. So.
Shelby Young, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like it's not an insignificant point either. Circling back to that idea of these bits of content which are missable or which don't hook into the wider game mechanic or game loop. So, you know, when you approach them, and it's not really when you approach the first or the second of these, it's when you approach like the seventh or the eighth and the player has learned by now that I can click on this thing or I can read this thing or I can trigger this audio, but I don't need to. And, you know, there will be players who are trying to do that thing of streamlining their experience. Unless it gives me some kind of reward. And that idea of a reward is weird because in a game, we often train players to think of rewards as that they've got to buff your stats in some way.
Right.
But actually, why are we playing the game in the first place? If we're playing it to have a nice time, the reward could be, you know, you get a funny joke, you get a line of dialogue, you get a beautiful moment. But the interesting thing about those things is that they are rewarding, but they don't actually exist in a vacuum. It's not fair to say that they do. Like a joke is funny because it's funny and it tells you something about the world or the life or the character. If it's an emotional moment, it tells you something about characters you need to already be invested in. Otherwise, you're not actually going to be interested in that emotional moment. So these rewards still have to hook into and connect with and join things up in the world. They aren't this sort of surface layer that can be added at the last minute and still feel valuable, I think. So I think the reason I say all of that is I'm still sort of musing on the haiku mechanic in Ghost of Tsushima, because the thing that bothers me about it is I love the sort of design concept of it. I love the idea of it just getting the player to sit in the world and to pull details from the world. It's that thing that they train you to do when you've had a traumatic experience, is just look around the room and notice things in the room to kind of ground yourself. And it's like a mechanicization of that. That's really clever. But if at the end of it, I produce a haiku, which I read and I think, yeah, that's not very good. Like, it's okay, but I'm not that bothered about the frogs. I could have chosen the cherry blossom. I don't have much at stake here. You know, by the time they get to the third or fourth of these, how do we stop that player from just hitting the first button that sort of comes by them? How do we encourage them to read it again? How do we make it valuable and make it connect to something? And I think I don't think that's hopeless. I think that's just an interesting problem to solve. It's like, actually, what I need is I don't know, the frogs to tell me something about the childhood of my character or the emotional resonance or the state of mind. I have to learn something that's more than just the description itself. Because after all, haiku is famously a very difficult form of poetry to do really well, right? Like, a lot of haikus are not very good, precisely because the ones that are good are good for mysterious reasons. Like, they really work. So it's a very ambitious thing to do. But I think it's kind of, I love getting to that level of, that we can be getting to that level of challenge as writers for games, that we're not just making the game function and we're not just making sure the player knows where they're going next, but we're saying, how do we make this moment feel worthwhile just in and of itself, just as part of the text? Because if you're writing a movie and you don't have a bit where the characters say something funny or nice to each other, then you've got a very boring movie. Like, you build the plot so you can do the character on top, so you can add the detail on top. Which reminded me of something that I was thinking when I was reading your article, which was, I was thinking not so much about poetry, but song. Obviously, song is just a variation of poetry. And you don't often see songs in games, but I have a feeling that every time you do, it's the most memorable bit of the game. Like, everyone remembers the songs in, what is it, Kentucky Route Zero's got one. I think The Last of Us, or possibly Last of Us Part Two, has one. Like, Hades obviously has a couple. Like, every time somebody starts singing, we all just go, oh, we're going to remember this moment forever. And it's something to do with the emotion in the music is really clear. We get it. We know what it's for. And the poetry you can just about connect with, because we're good at songs as human beings. We really understand them in modern culture. So,
I just finished, I worked backwards. And so I just finished Portal. I was late to the Portal games. So I just finished Portal. It was like my post-thesis treat to myself. I was like, I'm going to play Portal. And
So you got the song. Still here.
I got the song.
We're still alive. Still alive.
Still alive. And
the greatest. It's so good.
I'm obsessed with this song. I think it's so clever. It's so well written.
I literally played it on loop, I think maybe 300 times when I first heard it. Like, I just had it in the background
It's a great song, but it also, like, for me, it helped me make sense of some of the things that had gone on in the game. It was just, there was something, the lyrics kind of pull you back into that. I'm like, oh, right, okay. Like, I just had this intense experience and now I'm trying to kind of process it. And the lyrics of that song kind of were helping me do that. And so I think that, and I think that's something that poetry also does. And they are very much related. I mean, coming from Hebrew, like, it's almost a cliche now, but the word for song and poem are exactly the same in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. They're both shir. And that's the case, I think, in other languages, some other languages as well, like in Arabic. So the connection between song and music is so closely, song and poetry is so closely linked. But yeah, I think that, like, for instance, with this, the haiku compositional moments in Ghost of Tsushima, I mean, I think there, I haven't played the game at all, so I'm just kind of imagining things. But I think that there's always a bit of a risk in those sort of, like, compositional moments, because you're with, like you said, John, that, you know, sometimes, like, at a certain point, like, what's going to compel the player to choose Frog again? And so you have to kind of, if you're pulling from the environment, then that environment has to sort of change for the player as they move through the game. There has to be something, either these, like, objects that they're pulling start to take on other meanings as they play, or the environment itself is different so that they're encouraged to grab different things. You know, so I think that, and I think that's just, like, that's an interesting design challenge. It's like, and that's also a lot of time and money that goes into kind of, like, making those options available to a
player.
That's
what they did, though. They pick different locations, so they're all distinct.
Yeah, that makes sense. But yeah, I think
And I think it tracks with, like, your progression through the story a bit, so
that's
that,
cool.
Well, it is hard to do. I mean, I think you would almost, the problem of bad poetry, well, it's an interesting problem, right? But you would almost, if you want it to be good poetry, you want the player to feel like, oh, this is amazing, you would need to somehow convey to them, like, you must think of this as a whole, not just as, like, all these individual lines, or you must, like, or you pre-write every version of that and ensure that it's good. But that is impossible to do on the scale of, like, what you probably need to do.
It's really
make
hard.
Sure that every iteration will be nice.
Yeah, I think, though, that if you are inviting a player to be creative, to have this creative moment in the game, then that is what's meaningful about it. What's meaningful is the invitation to participate or to enact this sort of creative expression. For me, it's less about like, is the end result a compelling poem in its own right? Yeah, I mean, right. Most likely it's not, it's hard for it to be when you've given players a very limited pool of options. So I think those are the limits of even, a game like Play a Hot Number. There are only so many lines you can recombine. But I think what's meaningful there is just creating an opportunity for a player to be creative. And I think there's something really meaningful in that. And again, it's not going to always work narratively in every game to do that. But I can see how, like, there was something one of you said, I think, no, maybe it was John, just that the idea that, I'm struck by, like, that how this moment can happen after a very intense, say, combat situation, or, you've gone through a traumatic memory of the playable character, and then suddenly, you're in this, like, poetic campfire, and you're given this moment to sort of pause and process. And I think poetry is like a great form for doing that kind of work. And I do think that sometimes we underestimate a player's willingness to take that time to sort of reflect and process on what they've been doing. And I think it's an important thing sometimes to include, because I think some of these games, I'm thinking of Returnal, has these very personal boss combat situations. And I remember like sometimes finally getting through one of them and just being like, I need a break. and the game doesn't quite allow for that, but it was interesting for me to sort of track those moments where I was like, I need to spend some time with what I've just done. So yeah.
Yeah. I think that it's quite nice to bring the idea of constructing poetry back to finding that balance between providing the player enough structure that they end up with a result they can be, satisfied with, but enough freedom that they can feel creative. Because in a way, that's true of pretty much all game design in all contexts, right? We're always looking for a way for the player to have enough agency that it's theirs and they can own it, but not so much that they can get lost and run out of things to do. I think that's a great point to finish our conversation. It's been a lovely 45 minutes. Thank you so much for joining us, Adriana. It's been really, really cool to look at that lens and take that angle on game writing and narrative. Listeners, please join us again next week when we will interview another writer from the wonderful game Narrative Kaleidoscope. But until then, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.